Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Walter Matthews. He goes by Sparky. He's a retired colonel from the Air Force and also the first Surgeon General of the U.S. Space Force. And he is currently serving as a clinical professor in honors and the Honors College for Pre-Medical Advisors at Baylor University. Sparky, thanks for joining me today.
Nick, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
So this is really a dream come true for me. I've got to be honest. You have an illustrious career, huge, extensive bio of experience that is just so contextual to what we're going to explore, which is, you know, the advances in space medicine and how we get there. Before we do, I think it's worth just covering off a little bit of your background. And please, keep it brief because we haven't got the whole show. But tell us how you got here and, you know, any specific inflection points that were really important from your time in the past.
Well, sure. So I am an aerospace medicine specialist. That's my discipline of study within medicine. And I had a traditional undergraduate pre-med education, had a mentor that steered me towards the Air Force, did a scholarship to go through medical school on the Air Force's dime, and ended up loving it and stayed for 28 years. Decided when I was in medical school that nothing really was to my liking as far as my rotations. And so I became a flight surgeon, an aerospace medicine doc. Decided I enjoyed that so much. I did a residency in aerospace medicine and then got out and you know, took care of pilots and their families and flew many different airframes in the Air Force. And eventually got into space medicine when I was assigned to the Air Force Space Command. And that is truly where we are headed for the future. And unfortunately, my time in the Air Force came to an end, but I'm continuing to try to inspire pre-med students here at Baylor University to pick up that mantle and head into space.
It really feels like some of what we've watched on, you know, Hollywood's serving of science fiction is getting closer and closer to the point that, you know, I can feel it. I don't know about others. So that sort of inflection from aerospace to the Space Force, that was a new group. You were the first, to serve in there. How did that come about? Were you applying for it? Did it just, you know, what was the story behind that?
Well, that's a great question. So I spent a year in Afghanistan in command of the Bagram Craig Joint Theater Hospital. And coming out of that assignment, the people that decided what I wanted to do decided that the Air Force Space Command command surgeon job was a great place for me to go. And so got there, and, you know, that was before the Space Force existed. And just about, so as I was driving into town to Colorado Springs to take over that assignment, I heard President Trump give his speech on the radio about the Space Force. And I realized, baby, it's a new story now. This is really going places.
It's interesting you talk about the powers that be, but they obviously read your mind correctly, because I know this is an area of passion for you. Is that just coincidence, or is there some real science going on here?
Well, you know, Nick, it's interesting that you ask that, because my entire career seemed to follow the line of making the most of where I was. And finding the greatness in whatever opportunity I was given. And so I always enjoyed space. I thought that was a really interesting, interesting way to practice medicine, preparing astronauts to go to space. But when I got to Air Force Space Command, and then we started talking about Space Force, I realized that we're not just talking about preparing astronauts to go to space. We're talking about the practice of medicine in space, and what a spectacular frontier that is for us to breach. And we're there. And I'm eager to tell you about that if you're interested.
Oh, absolutely. You can't believe how excited I am about this. That would have been my career had that been the option. So you get to Space Force. This is a new group, obviously not something that was entirely new, but the formation of that. This must have been exciting. Tell us a little bit about some of the experiences, some of the things that were going on at the time, and you know, a little bit of insight as to where you see opportunity and the challenges.
Certainly. So when Space Force first started in December of 2019, that's when the president signed it into existence. It was the greatest explosion of energy in an organization that I've ever witnessed.
Wow.
Suddenly we had, you know, so many more people coming in, and we were starting to strategically dream. You know, you talk about strategic planning, but we were strategically dreaming, thinking about what can we do? What's possible in the future? You know, as we work with NASA, SpaceX, the United Launch Associates, Blue Origins, Jeff Bezos's group, you know, we really have the opportunity to do amazing things. And, you know, honestly, our goal at this point, the entire U.S. space program, whether it's military, civilian, or commercial, is Mars, is to go to Mars, is to put human feet on the surface of Mars. And I think that most of your listeners may not realize just how close we are to doing that. But the problem is, you know, if we're talking about going to the space station, you know, you can, if somebody gets sick or injured there, we can bring them back, you know, and take care of them like that. And we can do a lot of things on orbit as well. If you go to the moon, you know, you have to, you're 2 or 3 days flight, you know, from the moon back to Earth orbit. If you go to Mars, that's 9 months. One-way trip. And so we it's not enough to prepare our astronauts to go to Mars. We have to be able to provide care for them while they're there. And so that's really where we are heading in the immediate and the mid and distant future as far as medicine in space.
So take you know, Earth orbit, let's call that the easiest, and I know it's not. What are some of the challenges that you've faced, you've seen? I know we've certainly had some medical experience with all of the flights that have gone. Tell us a little bit about that and the medicine in orbit and in zero gravity.
Certainly. And so when we send astronauts to orbit, our astronauts are selected to be nearly physically perfect specimens. You know, if they have, and we tune them up to maximum performance before we send them on orbit. Because if they have a medical issue there, not only does that, you know, that cause problems with the mission, but their entire crew has to come back because we don't just switch out one astronaut. And so that's really what we've done throughout the entire 60 years of the space program, is ensuring that we have extremely healthy astronauts to go. But that's kind of the way aviation started as well. You know, with aviation, when it was born in the early 1900s, you didn't have a lot of people flying in the air. And so you could afford to be very selective about who did that. Well, space travel will eventually be the same as air travel is today. And so more and more people will go to space. And so when you think about that, I had a professor once that said, an impossible event given an infinite amount of time becomes inevitable. And so, you know, if we put enough people in space on orbit for enough time, we're eventually going to have a life-threatening emergency or you know, illness or injury. You know, we've had some medical issues in space in the past. I'm not at liberty to talk about the details, but, you know, that's eventually going to happen. And if we have a preventable death in space, then the American public will take Mars out of our grasp. And so we have to, and by, you know, in addition to the fact that we certainly have to be, you know, protect our folks that are going to the maximum extent that we can. And so as we look to the moon, as we look to long duration orbit, as we look to Mars, you know, we have to look at this the same way we do a military deployment. I'm a military officer, and so, you know, that's the way I think. And we never send individuals into combat without bringing medical support with them, okay? So we're going to have to do that in space as well. And so, you know, the really there's three lines of effort, strategic lines of effort that we're looking at as far as what we have to do to be able to go to Mars, because that is the goal. If we can go to Mars, we can go an infinite distance away from the Earth. So the three things we have to do is we have to figure out how we do medical evacuation to Earth orbit. The second thing we need to figure out is how we do strategic patient movement between planetary orbits, starting with the moon. And the third thing is we have to, and this is the exciting one, we have to figure out how we do medical and surgical resuscitation on the surface of other planets. And that's where most of our dramatic technological advances are going to have to come. So I can talk about one or all of those if you'd like.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus on the latter because I think that's where, you know, much of the innovation, and not to oversimplify it for folks listening, but I would say certainly the first two are more about, you know, scoop and run.
Right.
Get them back as quickly as possible. You know, if you understand orbital mechanics, you understand how challenging that is.
Right.
So it's a little bit more than scoop and run, but, you know, in the context of this. So let's jump forward because you've already said it's a lot closer than people think. I'm with you. You can see this acceleration, amazing innovation. Start with some of the basic challenges around this. I mean, do we have doctors in orbit that, you know, are servicing this? How do we do this?
Well, we don't have a mission specific role for a physician in space. So we've had astronauts that were physicians, but they didn't go to serve as a physician. And certainly we didn't have trauma surgeons, OR nurses, critical care specialists, which is what we're going to need as we go further. And so we'll set aside the moon for a second, but think about the fact that whatever we do on Mars, we will practice by doing it first on the moon. Okay, so let's jump forward to Mars, mm-hmm. because Mars is so far away that we have to provide the care to an injured or ill astronaut there on Mars. You know, we can't just bring them back and fix them here. Okay.
Right.
So the challenges that we face are primarily the getting stuff to Mars. So getting medical equipment to Mars. In the early days of the Apollo program, one of the astronauts went to one of the flight engineers and said, "Hey, I'd like to take some things with me when I go, you know, to the moon. What's the weight restriction?" And he said, "Well, you know, whatever you want to take with you, go out in the front yard and throw it up in the air. And if it comes back down, it's too heavy." Okay. And so we really are restricted in the payload weight that we can take with us. And so anything that we can produce on site on Mars is something we have to do. And so, you know, certainly if we think about a typical surgical capability, we're going to have to take the anesthesia machine. We're going to have to take the surgical bed with us. We'll have to take the ventilator. You know, the complex machinery we'll have to take with us. But do we need to take a pharmacy? Do we need to take a blood bank? Do we need to take supplies like gauze and surgical instruments and things like that? All of those challenges, all of those materials will likely be produced by 3D printing on Mars. And so a research team up at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, it's a military medical school here, has already printed red blood cells on a 3D bioprinter. And the FDA is currently evaluating those to see if they actually function as red blood cells. But this, you know, this is the first step in a frontier that is almost unimaginable. It's almost at the level of Star Trek, where we type in what we want and the printer makes it. Okay. And so imagine if we could print organs. That there's experimentation going on the space station right now printing kidneys. Imagine if we could print surgical instruments. If we could print replacement parts for the machinery that we take up to Mars. If we could simply print blood products, then our need for a blood bank or storage of massive amounts of blood products would be a thing of the past. Now, people ask, why are we spending all this time and effort and money in space exploration? Imagine if that innovation that we use for space could be brought to the Earth. And blood banks are the thing of the past. And bloodborne infections and Rh incompatibility, graft versus host reactions from the immune system are gone because we can print the blood cells without antigens. So, I mean, that's just massive potential. If we could print the molecular structure of medications that we need, and so you don't have to take a pharmacy. If we can print gauze, if we can print, anything that we need, essentially all you have to do is have the pressure vessel, where you have the OR, you have your equipment that you bring with you, and then you make everything else. Spectacular possibilities with that.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dr. Walter Matthews. He goes by Sparky. He's a clinical professor in honors and the Honors College pre-med advisor at Baylor University, and also the first Surgeon General of the U.S. Space Force. We're talking about I want to call it the colonization of space, right? I mean, that's not unreasonable. The step away into the remote distance, and the challenges of that time, inability to sort of bring services and what you need to bring. 3D printing as a basics technology, we've seen that. You've covered some of those. We've seen it with drugs, organs. What about the challenges of air quality or lack of air, the decreased pressure, and also the reduction in gravity? We've seen the impact on the body, a lot of great studies, the work from NASA and others. How are we going to cope with that? Because that seems like a problem it's going to persist, right?
Certainly. So the gravitational field of Mars is a roughly one-third Earth's gravity. I believe that's correct. And so you bring up an interesting point that when we have astronauts that go to orbit and they're in microgravity, so virtually no gravity, they go through bone demineralization because they lose some of their cardiovascular reflexes. Mm-hmm. They have some muscle wasting because they're not using postural muscles. So we haven't spent an extended amount of time in a lower gravity environment such as the moon or Mars. And so we're going to be learning some of this as we go. But if the human is required to use musculature to stand, then that activates the postural muscles in such a way that we believe that most of that bone demineralization will not be an issue when we get to long duration being on other planets, essentially. Our bigger concern with that is how the body reacts when it's trying to heal. So you have increased caloric requirements, you have massive oxygen requirements that go along with the calories. For injuries and surgical injuries to heal. And so, wherever we go, if we go to the moon, we have to take oxygen with us in some form. When we go to Mars, one of the things that people wonder, why are we looking for water on Mars? Why are we trying to find that ice? Well, that's where oxygen is going to come from. And there is NASA just landed a Mars rover, and I can't remember the name of the rover. But one of the experiments on that rover is converting atmospheric carbon dioxide in the Mars environment to oxygen, to breathable oxygen. If we're able to do that with this rover, we have one of our biggest problem is solved. Because if we have oxygen, then we can concentrate that oxygen to almost any pressure we desire. So pressure brings up another issue that we have to have a pressure vessel to 14 psi, roughly, the same that we have here on Earth, because the lower pressure causes a lower oxygen pressure, which decreases oxygenation of tissues, which then will cause inhibition of healing.
Yeah, so Perseverance is the rover, and it's stacked full of technology, lasers banging out. I've watched it.
Helicopters.
yeah, that's right. They had a drone included. Just incredible. Some extraordinary challenges. Obviously you've got people there. What do you think the scope is for some automation to sort of deliver some of this. We get the delivery of tools and capabilities, but what about actually delivering the care if necessary?
So that's a really interesting question. One of the frequent questions my students ask is, why do we need to send a surgeon to Mars? Can't we use the Da Vinci robot? Can't we use robotic surgery, somebody here on Earth doing those procedures? So the problem is the distance and the communication lag. So anyone that has observed surgery, and certainly anyone that has had a scalpel in their hand, knows that you know, even a half second delay between what you intend to do and what actually happens can cost a life. And so, you know, we may eventually get to the point where we can do that kind of automation. But and this kind of goes back to the difference between, you know, aircraft that don't have pilots, so remotely piloted aircraft, and aircrafts where you have a pilot with their butt in the seat. Okay, there's no fighter pilot in the world that's going to tell you that they can, you know, effectively complete air-to-air combat with another aircraft sitting in a semi-tractor trailer, you know, behind a screen. Right. You've got to be there, and I believe that that's how we'll start with medical care on Mars. And this is kind of a reverse. I think we'll start with people, and then as our technology advances, we will eventually regress back to, we'll move to robotic surgery or robotic procedures.
Right.
There's not a whole lot that we can do totally robotically right now in medicine. So robotic surgery can take the shake, the micro shakes out of a surgeon's hand, but they can't replace the hand.
So unfortunately, we're running out of time, and I want to be sure to get a couple of sort of key questions in. One is, you know, if people want to get into this and, you know, focus on this, some thoughts about that. You've obviously managed to architect a pathway into it. But the other one is a straightforward yes or no, faster than light drive or not?
I believe eventually.
Okay.
Only because humans refuse to be told no.
I'm with you because I'm a Trekkie. So I Now, what about folks, you know, as excited as me, but, you know, maybe earlier in their career? Sure. How do you get to this, and what should you be thinking about and doing so that you can be contributing and learning? Because I think, you know, the knock-on effect into our world is just going to be immense, as it was from NASA and Apollo and Gemini.
So the path to get to being a physician in space, and that's what I know, is it's a standard pathway all the way to the end of medical school. And then at the end of medical school, doing a residency in aerospace medicine. You can do that in any of the branches of the military, but we also have civilian programs. And there's a great civilian program at Wright State University in Ohio. But there's a space-specific program or a space-focused program at the University of Texas Medical Branch down in Galveston. And they actually work in the bioastronautics clinic at NASA at Johnson Space Center. So that discipline is how you get into space medicine. And once you get into the discipline, it's a matter of, you know, if you want to go the civilian route, talking to NASA. SpaceX, I know, is starting to develop a space medicine function within their organization. And certainly within the military, you can, right now, physicians can't join the Space Force, but we can join the Air Force, which supports Space Force in providing medical support.
Exciting stuff. So if it were to come up, if somebody walked in and said, Sparky, we'd like you to go to space tomorrow, would you go?
I would, but only after asking my wife, Monica, which means I wouldn't. she's been without me on deployment for too many months, too many years in my career. So
right. Well, at this point in my career, it just seems everything is getting faster, quicker. We're getting there. All of this exciting technology. Can't thank you enough for spending a little bit of time with me. Very excited about the potential. And all of the things that we've learned and are going to learn in the future. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Nick. It's been a true pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.